something outside.
What is that?
Radio.
Good afternoon, Monster X listeners. This is Gunnar Monson. Along with me, as always, is my good friend Shane Hardcore Corson. Shane, how are you doing today?
Hey, doing well, Gunnar. Glad to be here. I'm looking forward to the show as always. Super great guest. And I'm doing well. How are you doing, sir?
I am good. The weather is starting to look more like summer, even here in Oregon. So. We've been having I've had a busy couple weeks. We actually went down, Susan and Jake and I went down to the Redwoods for a quick trip and spent 4th of July in Florence, Oregon, and had a good time. Got back. We've got Beachfoot coming up. The OP expedition is coming up right the weekend after that. And then you and I are hosting inaugural Oregon Bigfoot Festival coming up.
Yeah.
And the date, I'm not looking at my calendar. You got the date there handy?
On the top of my head, no, I do not.
It is the 19th of August.
Yeah,
so.
We got so much going on. It's crazy. I got all my dates kind of mixed up, but they are on the calendar, so I will be there for those events.
Don't worry, I'll be calling you to make sure that you make it. So. Yeah,
I appreciate that.
Next, it's crazy. It's actually, we're taking Jake is going to basketball camp next week, or let's see, week after next. He's going to the Damian Lillard basketball camp. He's Dame's one of his favorite players, and he's excited about that. So then Susan, after actually the week after the OP expedition, Susan and I are taking a week hike. And going to go hike the Salmonberry Trail. So.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah.
Yeah.
Very,
so
very squatchy area.
It is a very squatchy area. And I know that our buddy Larry was out there last week. I think he ran into a bear out there.
Yeah,
he seemed to be pretty active
cubs.
This year.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So I understand that you've been busy with the nesting area there in Washington, the OP's research area. How anything interesting going on there?
Yeah, you know, I've been extremely busy in that area. I've been trying to do some audio stuff out there, not necessarily thinking that's, you know, anything's in the area in particular. You know, there are bear in this area. We've got some bear recently on trail camera. I camped out there, not in the nesting site, but a little ways away with Shelly Cumton, Montana from Texas. And we did find, you know, a lot of bear activity, and we did do some more collection samples, hair collection samples out in the nesting area, the primary nest site. For those of you keeping up with it, we found 21 total nests so far of something. You know, I'm not saying it's Sasquatch per se, but something's made these extraordinarily odd nests. And so we were out there collecting hair, more hair. We had the funny thing was I was out there with Shelly, and we did have something below the, towards the creek area, below the nesting area, about 40 yards out, that was making a little bit of a ruckus. Could have been a bear. It's just some odd sounds, so odd things that make you go, maybe it's not a bear. When you start hearing, you know, some odd little knocking noises and some odd whistles. And the thing that stuck on my head when we were out there at that time, which I believe we do have on recorded, I've yet to review those recordings, but yeah, I got three loud whacks. And I was telling you before the show, Gunnar, these whacks were kind of weird because it wasn't like a, a solid limb. You know, it was more like a limb with branches on it. You know, you get that kind of rake sound when you hit the ground with all these branches with leaves.
Mm-hmm.
Three solid, really quick ones, and went, huh, that was odd, you know, and it was fairly close. Something was in the area for a good 45 minutes, maybe longer, but it went quiet after about then. I never saw anything. I tried, whatever it was, but just out of eyesight. Could have been a bear, sure. There were some barks out there before we had, you know, gotten down into the area, which could have been bear. I don't think coyote, though. I can't rule that out. So it was, you know, that was kind of fun. Didn't, like I said, didn't get anything visually, but we did pull a lot of hair out of the nest, a lot more hair, and it was kind of neat because it was Shelly Covington's first time. You know, she's a member of the Elk Project. It was her first time out there, and she, you know, to get her feedback, her thoughts, and her ideas. You know, and once again, you know, she was just like everybody else that's been to this area, both citizen scientists and scientists and whatnot, and members of the OP. They come away with more questions than answers, so that was nice. And for the record, I will say that we've had a few people reach us and ask us, hey, you know, could this be a wood rat's nest? And no,
I was just thinking about that.
Yeah, it is not. I worked in Southern California, Northern California, Washington, Oregon. I've seen my fair share of nests, wood rat nests, and other nests. This is not wood rat nests. Whatever made these nests, and they are nests, made them completely out of huckleberry. It did not collapse in. They were formed to the nest shape. Some of the huckleberry was pushed into the ground, helping to form the nest. And, yeah, there was a lot of thought put behind something intelligent made these nests. I can't say Sasquatch. We've had bear biologists look at it, like I've told people a million times, and other biologists, they don't know what it is. It just, from our aspect and what we're seeing in the few primatologists we've talked to, it looks like a gorilla nest. Well, there's no gorillas in North America. So that's where we're at right now. The hair that we've had looked at, you know, it's, you know, that everybody hates it, but it's come back on. No, not all of it. They found, you know, bear hair and raccoon and deer and the surrounding surrounding areas, but the suspect hair that I've got a keen eye for now, that's been nestled into the branches of this nest deep down. It's the same hair found in the different layers of the nest. So whatever this hair is whatever made the nest, in my opinion, and it's come back unknown, hominid possibly. You know, so that's exciting, and we'll see where it goes from there. But we'll do a show. We'll do a show down the road here on this to talk about it more. If you go to the Kennedy
right.
Conference in Washington in a couple of months here, there'll be a lot laid out there, as well as the Sasquatch Summit. And we'll talk about stuff on this show. You're not going to hear anywhere else, but you'll hear it on Monster X Radio. You know, and yeah, you know, we're as excited about this as many other people are. You know, and we'll see where it goes. That's all we can do.
Yeah, and there's I know that there's an ongoing investigation. They're part of the nest samples have been sent on to have the new DNA now analysis that allows for a lot that's a lot more extensive than what was available previously. And, that's
yeah, eDNA. eDNA.
Right.
And that's
yeah.
that. These samples are being sent off to Dr. Todd Disattel out of New York, and we're trying to raise more funds, you know, some funds here with Indigo. I know it's on Dr. Jeff Meldrum's page, trying to raise some money. So, you know, they're about $1,000 per sample to be tested. This isn't cheap, and that's why we're, you know, we're hoping to raise the more money raised, the more samples get tested, you know, and we have personally pumped
right.
our own money into this. This isn't just hey, give me money, or, you know, this is, you're really going to be supporting something that may, you know, no promises.
Right.
There is never promises. I'm never going to promise anything,
right.
But there's enough people involved in this that really feel soundly about this, and it's being handled a lot differently than some of the other stuff that you've seen over the years. I'm not going to mention names. I'm not going to mention studies. But they've led nowhere. Unfortunately, people can argue,
right.
"Oh, they did," but they really did it. This is why we're still here doing this. So it's exciting. I know there's tons of other research groups, research individuals doing amazing work out there. That if they had something like this, I would support them wholeheartedly. Let move forward.
Mm-hmm.
So I hope to have that in return. And I have supported other people and individuals and groups before. We hope to see that here, because really, collectively, this isn't a one-man show. It's not a one-group show. It's a community show, a community effort. And so if people are interested and really want to see, you know, possible results, we're here. Let's see what happens. You know, help either promote it or help fund it. And, yeah, so exciting stuff. And like I said, there are no promises in this. But what I've seen so far with this is another step in the right direction. This is science being involved. And the only unfortunate thing is it does take money to get it done, but that's always going to be the case.
Yeah, it's like every piece of evidence. To me, the OP's going about this the right way because nobody's saying that this is Bigfoot. It's a very unusual find. And you got to put everything in context. I know there's been some. I've seen the naysayers out there that it's this or that, and they don't have all the information. They haven't been to the site. You know, one of the most compelling things to me was and Derek Randall is the consummate outdoorsman. I mean, he doesn't just pull things out of his ass to talk about. When he was talking about the condition of the huckleberry on that entire ridgeline. When he first was up there, it was impressive because the way he described it is decimated, you know, that it wasn't, that no chew marks, that there's all this huckleberry at various heights up to like 8 feet. Is that correct? Like where these huckleberries
snapped off. Oh yeah.
Snapped off.
Right. See, real quick. So I took Shelley off this location. Mm-hmm. That was one of the things that blew her away. They were clearly snapped off. And you can go, they're clearly snapped off upwards of some at the 2 foot level up to 8 foot level. Now, not every, there's 21 nests spread out over, 5-6 fingers coming off a ridge. And the exciting thing is, not every ridge or every finger has a nest, nor is the huckleberry snapped off. So it's very clear, and not always snapped off, sometimes it's just snapped and twisted, sometimes it's just snapped and broken. It's not snow fall. It's not tree fall. You can find that stuff. Huckleberry will bend a lot of times. It won't just break. And they're snaps. And now the regrowth is coming. And this area in about, I'm guessing, a year will be completely unrecognizable because all the huckleberry would have grown back. We're now into let's pick up the pace mode because it is starting to grow back. We've taken, you know, about as much pictures and measurements and samples as we need or can take, and so now we're taking this to the next level where it is pick up the pace, involve science, which we've done from day one, but let's get this test, and we did bring Dr. Jeff Meldrum up there to look at it, and once again blown away and like had nothing he'd ever seen before. And so we'll definitely cover this more. Maybe we'll do a show here soon because I love talking about this. There's a lot of information. There's others out there that can find this. It'd be really cool to find this sort of setup somewhere else. You know, it'd be very cool to duplicate this somewhere else. We're working on that right now. The only project is currently working on trying to find, giving all the characteristics and what we think we're looking at. Trying to find duplicate this somewhere else. I know there's other individuals out there that have come across singular nests. It'd be really cool to find nests of this caliber, which includes more than one, anywhere up from, two to five in one given area. That'd be exciting.
Yeah. Well, I know that we could talk about this all day long, but we do have a gentleman waiting for us to join us on the show today. David Becara is a Bigfoot investigator. And he is also the owner and operator of the Expedition Bigfoot Museum in Georgia. So let's bring David on and get the show on the road. David, thanks for hanging out with us today. Welcome to Monster X Radio.
Hey guys, nice. Thanks for having me.
So we get excited about the. Are you familiar with the what's going on up in Washington with the Olympic project?
Yes, I've been following it as much as I can in my schedule as it allows it. But I find that kind of stuff fascinating. And I got to tell you something, that I have the utmost respect for the guys that are in the field doing the work. So, when you really think about all the people that are involved in the Bigfoot world, what is there, maybe 5%. They're out there actually getting the bites and doing the sweat and the labor out there. So just hats off to you guys. The rest of us appreciate it. I get out in the field. I've got cameras. I'm a field guy myself. Even running the museum, I work more hours now than I ever did, but I always find time to do investigations. So you guys are doing a great job, great work, and the rest of us appreciate it.
Well, thank you, Dave.
Well, thank you, David. Yeah, thank you. Same back to you. I know, and that's well said, there are tons of individuals out there, boots on the ground, spending their hard-earned money, time, and doing this sort of endeavor because they enjoy it and it's a passion and they, you know, there's something to it. And so, no, thank you for that comment and right back at you.
Thanks, guys.
So Dave, let's get started. Tell the Monster X Radio listeners a little bit about yourself. What's your background and how did you join this crazy world of Bigfooting?
I was in the restaurant business for about 25 years. When I moved up here to Georgia, I was driving a truck, a long haul truck, and we just kind of landed here by accident. Came here up on vacation in North Georgia mountains, and fell in love with it. So I kind of ended up here by accident. Never thought about opening up a Bigfoot museum, and when I moved up here, but I've been doing this since I was about 12 years old, and I saw the Legend of Boggy Creek, my brother Mark and I. And for a lot of guys, it really started us off on that. It was just such a jarring movie back in the 70s before we had all the internet and all the special effect movies. And that really captured my brothers and I attention. And so I checked every book out in the school library. I watched every documentary that came on TV, all the In Search Of and Monsters and Mysteries and all those great shows. And I finally had an opportunity to go on an expedition with the BFRO about 6 years ago, 7 years ago. And I think it might even be 8 years ago. And I became an investigator for the state of Florida. And, you know, I thought I was interested beforehand, but once you become an investigator and you start traveling all over your state, doing one-on-one interviews with people, it really changes the whole perspective on this because you get such an incredible mixture of stories. You don't always get those real sanitized stories that you read on the internet. You start to get some really raw stories being told with emotion and the whole thing takes on a whole new feel when it has that kind of that personal touch to it. So I'm about as deep in it now as I've ever been.
And with David, now when you first got into, when you went on these BFRO expeditions, what did you take away? I mean, it must have got you – I mean, obviously you got more involved. You started actually doing your own investigations, interviewing people. But, you know, with your – what was your first impression going out with, you know, a group of BFRO individuals? And then how did that – you know, how did that exactly bring you to where you're at now?
Well, you know, we all have a starting point in the Bigfoot world. We're all – we all got to start somewhere. And well, I went out with an expedition with some very nice people I'm still friends with. And we went out and did the we camped out and we were doing the wood knocks. It's amazing, too, because the first expedition I was on was a very active area in North Florida. And we actually had two visuals that night, which was very exciting because that doesn't always happen. Most of the time you're going to go out, you're going to get nothing. And we just got really lucky. I wasn't a person that had a visual. But one of my friends, two of the people on the expeditions who are now my friends had visual sightings. And I actually made friends with some other folks up there that have a habituation site. We go down to visit them about maybe twice a year. We stay on the property. So I still have friends there with the BFRO. I'm still an active investigator for them. But my friends in the Bigfoot world, they just encompass all kinds of different groups. So I'm not strictly BFRO. I have so many friends from every walk of life that are investigators and researchers, and I think that's the part I love so much is just a mixture of everybody. You know, we've got some guys that are strictly looking for, you know, relic hominids. Some are looking strictly for some kind of unintelligent ape. We've got some folks that are out there looking for a more supernatural being. And I'm not closed-minded to any of it. I'm open-minded to all of it, especially, you know, you come to realization that these animals are, these creatures are much smarter than I thought they were when I first started this journey. The way they evade our trail cameras and audio, and it's a rabbit hole, but I've loved the trip so far, and I hope I have got another 20 years to go.
Yeah, no, that's a great point, David. You know, when you mention when you get into this, you know, especially I would say most people, most individuals, most investigators, enthusiasts, you think, you know, you're dealing with, you just don't realize how smart or the intelligence level of a Sasquatch, which has to be intelligent, you know, and we can say, and I say this quite frequently, you know, they're masters of their environment. They're like the ninjas of the forest, but there's more to it than that. You know, I'm pretty good in the woods. You know, I can hunt something. I can stay hidden, but I can't do things to the level of Sasquatch can, including some of the things you mentioned. You know, I will leave more trace behind than a Sasquatch will when I'm in the woods, no matter how hard I try. And that's a really, it's a really good point. You know, have you personally, David, have you personally had a suspicious encounter, a personal encounter, something that you can't rule out or that was not Sasquatch?
We were on an investigation, my wife and I, in a little town called Alva, Florida, back in 2011, I believe it was, and at a commercial fisherman's property. And we had our first nighttime sighting there through a thermal camera. We observed two for about 12 minutes. We took turns. We had a little distraction going on over the campfire. One of us was in a little pup tent with the flaps drawn with just the thermal sticking out. And then we'd watch them for about 3 or 4 minutes. And we'd go out, tap the guy on the other person on the shoulder. He'd go in there and do the same thing. So I got a chance to all observe these two between 7 and 8 foot creatures. One was a little taller than the other. We observed them peeking at from trees from the swamp at us. And my wife was back on the thermals when she saw them just walk back off down to the swamp in the pitch dark to the thermal. It was great. I wasn't terribly frightened. I was in a guy's backyard. We had people there. Some of them were armed. And so I never felt threatened. I didn't get that horrible sense of fear. So I think I kind of got lucky with my first sighting. Then I was bluff charging the green swamp about 2 years after that. I was out placing cameras. I had my cameras out on power line routes, and I was changing batteries and my SD cards. I was heading out on my mountain bike. I think all I had was my mountain bike, some extra batteries, and a backpack, and, of course, my wood knocker. I said, you know, I'm headed to my car. Let me just do one wood knock. I think I'd done like three investigations there. I knew it was an active area. So I did a wood knock on a tree, and something came completely unglued out in the swamp. I'd never heard anything all day. It's very quiet back there, usually back there during the day when all the animals are laying down, kind of quiet. And this thing started coming out of the swamp in my direction. I could hear it breaking small trees and branches and thrashing around. I remember looking around thinking, holy cow, it's going to happen. I'm going to see. This is going to come right out. And the closer it got to me, it started off about maybe 80 yards away. I guess when it came to about 30 yards from breaking out of the forest in front of me, I completely lost my nerve. Here I am. I thought how ironic it was that here I am looking for something, and quite possibly the thing I'm looking for is about to come out into the forest in front of me. But it sounded so aggravated and pissed off. I don't know if I wanted that to be my first meeting with one. So I actually hopped on my mountain bike, and let me tell you something, I pedaled my ass off out of there. I remember stopping halfway around a curve to see if it bounced out around the curve, to see if it peeked its head around, whatever it was. And I remember even losing my nerve there, and I just got in my car and left. And I also had an encounter in a state park in North Florida. My wife and I were on a hike in an extremely active area. And I did a wood knock. First one, I didn't have my recorder playing or anything. I did a nice, clear wood knock, 2 o'clock in the afternoon. Beautiful. There's nobody back there. No houses, no structures, anything. I did a nice, clear 2 or 3 wood knocks, and something pushed a tree down, maybe 50 to 75 yards away up on a hilltop. and you could hear this tree busting, breaking, and cracking. You know the sound of a live tree going down. Because it's fighting. It's popping, cracking, snapping as it's going. It's not a dead tree. And that was an amazing time. So I've had a visual and then two extremely suspicious things happen to me.
Mm-hmm. Now, with all three, these all occurred in the state of Florida. Do you think you're dealing with what's known, especially down in Florida and some surrounding areas, the skunk ape? Would you call that the skunk ape, or what would you label that as?
Anytime you see one in Florida, it's going to be a skunk ape. When you see one up here in Georgia, it's going to be a wood booger or a booger or a wood ape or a mountain devil. So really, it's the same thing. But that's what we call them down in Florida, a skunk. It's got kind of a neat name to it. People like it, you know. So down in Florida, they call it skunk ape. We just actually put a brand new exhibit called the skunk ape exhibit, the Florida skunk ape, and then we just unveiled that 2 weeks ago.
Oh, fantastic! Yeah, we're definitely going to touch upon your museum. Because I haven't been there, but it's on my bucket list for sure. But, it is fascinating with the different names of Sasquatch around the country. They're usually all enveloped some sort of the same thing. You know, skunk ape, you think something kind of smelly, wood booger. Well, I mean, rock ape. I mean, all these different names, Bigfoot, Sasquatch, they all kind of have some similarities with the name. But I always, I always ask, especially those that are investigating different parts around the country, what they would call it, So I've talked to a few Florida investigators. I call it Bigfoot or Sasquatch, but I'm always just kind of curious as to what, the local investigators call it. Now, the other thing I thought was fascinating was, do you think with that encounter you had where this thing, you made a knock and this thing went crazy, and sounded like it was making a big ruckus. A friend of mine, a good friend of mine, Derek Randall, from One Project, always says, it's like Sasquatch just knows how far to stay back without being seen. Was that your impression? And do you think if you had stuck around long enough that you might have actually had a sighting with that particular encounter?
I think so. I think it was going to come out of there, but it wouldn't surprise me if what you described exactly what would have happened, where they do know just how far they can come and get the desired effect of you leaving the air without having to show themselves. I tell that to so many people. So, I was fishing. I had rocks thrown at me. I stepped out of my porch, took a lot more to have a cigarette. Something started throwing pine cones at me. It's the same story, just different, tiny little differences. But, man, they know how to get rid of you without showing themselves because they really just wanted you to move on. But they don't want to show themselves because, they don't want you coming back and looking for them.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. No, I 100% agree with that. I think they can just stay out of eyesight. They can make enough ruckus, throw things, make sounds you never heard before in the middle of the night that will, get, your average person, more than your average person, out of that area or out of the woods. I've encountered stuff like this, and I've talked to enough individuals, I never saw it, but, I'm a hunter. I've been hunting for 30 years, and I've never had something ever like this occur. So definitely, there's definitely something to that. Now, with Florida, David, can you describe, the areas that you are – what's in these areas? A lot of times in Florida, I know people describe the Sasquatch or skunk ape being around, palmetto leaves and swampy areas. Is that kind of what you experienced?
I'll tell you, there's so many different kinds of environments in Florida. You get the real swampy area, then Central Florida dries out a little bit. You got mostly just a lot of sandy plains with palmettos, and you get up a little farther up north, you got a little bit bigger timber, not real timber, but from Florida we got a little bit more timber. I think what's going on, in my opinion, is that there's more than one species of Bigfoot, and so confusion when you see a little different one in Florida, and then this tall, jet black, and very muscular, and then some guy in Georgia sees a thin, tall, slender, brown one, you know, they give it a different name, but I think what, in my opinion, I think just what it is we've just got more than one species of these things. So that's how they get their name. One of the ways they get their name, wood ape and wood booger and swamp ape and skunk ape. But, you know, you hear some nice stories of them down there in Florida where they're not so aggressive. They respect people's property and their gardens and whatnot. And then, you know, same thing up here in Georgia. Sometimes they're just complete a-holes. They just do stuff that just defies explanation. They descend on old people. Well, who does that? Why would a totally dominant creature descend upon an elderly couple and just bang on their house and take their dogs and howl and keep them up all night? You know, and they do the same thing in Florida. So, I mean, it's I think that's the reason what really keeps so many investigators hooked in this, because I said it before, it's like trying to nail Jell-O to the wall. Man, just as soon as you get this thing, you think you have some idea, you realize you ain't got no idea. You have a little thought maybe, but you know, they all do such strange things that just defy explanation. And I tell you, I want to touch on something. You said something about how, you know, how close they can come where you can see them. I find it fascinating how many people tell me that they smell these things. And I can smell this overpowering sense of smell of garbage or feces or mixture between body odor and feces, but I couldn't see it. And I think to myself, you know, I have a dog, I've been around bears, and usually you got to be pretty close to these animals to actually smell them. And it's amazing how sometimes in broad daylight when you're hunting, you can smell this thing, but you can't see it. So many people, and sometimes it isn't just a little whiff. I mean, it's like an overpowering stench of something so smelly, but you can't see it. So I hear that a lot. And I think maybe it's because it's a big animal. I don't know. I guess you could smell a moose from quite a ways off and not see it, but it always surprises me as how people can smell these things but can't see them. It's my own mystery I'm dealing with.
Yeah. No, you know, that's another great point, especially with those that I've interviewed over the years is a lot of times they just get this smell that's just so overpowering. They've never smelled anything quite like it in the woods, including in some visuals, you know, where they've smelt this thing before they've seen it, or they've seen it and then they've smelt it. It's overpowering. Not every encounter, especially with visual, has that smell associated, or the person that's witnessed a Sasquatch has smelt that smell. And I think possibly it is the distance, like you mentioned, and also the fact that, you know, maybe it's some sort of pheromone excreted, you know, during agitation or fright that could, you know, during your guys' thermal, when you guys got those two individuals on therm, did you smell anything during that?
No, I never smelled anything on any of those suspicious encounters I had. Never smelled anything, which is neat, which is something, because I've always wanted to, because I've had it described to me so many times. I'm just kind of dying to smell it. But people say it's once you smell it, you can't unsmell it. It's pretty damn stinky.
I mentioned this before on the show. When I lived in San Diego and my present trips down there, I always visit the San Diego Zoo. And on two occasions, I've had a chance to smell a male silverback gorilla. And on one occasion, I never saw the gorilla, but I sure as heck smelt him. It smelled like burnt rubber and garbage, and it was just awful. One of the zookeepers noticed my interest and said, yeah, that's the male silverback. I said, well, where is he? Oh, he's about, you know, 40 yards this direction up behind something. I'm like, wow, I never saw him. And then on the second occasion, later on down the road, I did in fact see him, and I smelled it, and there's no mistaking it, the smell. It was something that no matter where I'm at, if I smell that smell, I'm always going to know where that smell is coming from, because it's that distinct. Yeah, that distinct. So truly fascinating. With your thermal, you know, the thermal thing, I'm a big proponent of using therms at night and stuff. I mean, what were you guys doing? Did you feel when you caught these suspect individuals on the therm, did you guys do anything to possibly bring them in to the viewing area, or were you guys just scanning around and they were there? I mean, what was the story behind that?
He said he was a fisherman. He used to fish on the I can't remember the name of the river, but this guy just slaughter them all the time, and he'd smoke whatever was left to preserve them. And he said that was the key. Whenever he'd smoke his catch, these things would come in. So as soon as we got there, he already had the smoker ready. He says, as soon as you get here and get set up, you just let me know. We're going to kick the smoker off. And he was right. He had some fish heads he just threw in there to get the smell going. And, boy, I guess he kicked it off about 7:30, 8 o'clock. And by 10:45, we had the two hits on the thermi. He said they come right out of that swamp right there. And he says he knows because that's where he chased them into. He chased them across the yard the first night. I think it was a person with a gun in the middle of the night, and when it just jumped right over a 4-foot fence without breaking stride, he realized that this was not a person because he was breaking trees and branches and screaming. So that's what he did. He said he knew exactly what to do to get him to come in. And I've heard that before, that the smell of fish is almost an irresistible attractant to him.
Yeah, I've heard, I've got friends that you know, they say fish brings them in, or another mm-hmm. one was chicken. I'm partial either way. I'm not sure. I think if they're in the area and there's an interesting smell, though it sounds like this gentleman had ongoing, you know, activity, and so he felt that the fish seemed to bring him in, and it seems like you guys got results possibly from that. So, interesting stuff. David, you know, with your move from Florida to Georgia, we're talking about a little bit different terrain. I mean, is there a huge terrain difference, an environmental difference in these two areas, or are there a lot of similarities? And do you think, in your opinion, that there's equal amount of Bigfoot activity in both states, or is one state have more over the other?
Wow, what a great question. That's something I address almost every single day, because we have a full-size Florida map and a full-size Georgia map. And they fit, if you just take the Florida map and stick it under the Georgia, they fit right together. And you'll notice that there's all these sightings in Florida, 380 sightings, and Georgia is 130. And and I tell people, what do you think it's because they don't like to cross on over the Georgia border? And I tell them it's because the people in Florida, most of them aren't from Florida. A lot of them, that might be first, second generations, but a lot of them moved there from Ohio and Michigan and Missouri and New Jersey and New York. They come from all over the place. They don't have like a super vested interest in the community. Their parents didn't have a business there that they took over, and all their cousins and aunts and uncles don't live there. So when they see a Bigfoot, they're more likely to report it because they're not too awfully worried about the outcome of somebody ridiculing them. But in Georgia, it's a whole different story. And same thing in Mississippi and Alabama. These folks are fourth, fifth, sixth generation Georgians. And when they see a Bigfoot, they're the last people to report it because all their cousins live there. Their great uncle is a pastor down at the church down the road. Their other uncle owns the grocery store. Their mom works at the post office where their dad used to work. Everybody they went to school there, they know. So these folks, when they see a Bigfoot, they'll tell their mother, brother, father, sister, and that's it. That's as far as it goes. But since we opened up this museum, I thought there might be a few sightings up here. I read the BFRO reports. I talked to a few people, you know, when I was in the restaurant business up here for a short period of time when we first moved up here. But holy cow, now that we've opened up the museum right on the main road, 515, it's like a lightning rod. People are coming out of the woodwork, police officers, nurses, oh my goodness, business owners, you just name it. People that are farmers up here that don't even go to museums, they had to come by and tell us about the print they found on their property and the cow that was getting ready to calf that was killed. They found on the corner of the property, the head was twisted around, the whole front corner was pulled off. Some came back and killed all their chickens. A white one was looking at it, and it just like goes on and on and on. And we are flabbergasted as to how active it is up here. So I was under the impression that there weren't as many sightings up here. As it turns out, there's probably even more sightings up here. It's just that they don't get reported. that element of the person that sees it, that goes to make the report, that's the missing cog in the machinery, that they just don't make the report. And the terrain up here is completely different. It's all flat down in Florida, sand. Up here, it's all pine and oak trees. You know, the highest point in Florida is 304 feet. Our cabin, we live in a log cabin at 2,300 feet. And we're not even the high point around here. The mountain that's right around the corner, Rich Mountain, that's had sightings, it's almost 4,000 feet. So it's very, very hilly. And for, you know, southeastern standards, it's quite mountainous. And so the terrain up here is just perfect, because people that live up here, they just stick to the trails. And there's just miles and miles of forest up here that people just don't get off the trail because it's just too treacherous.
That is an absolute gem of information that you just provided. An absolute gem. I really appreciate stuff like that because it's not an area that I go to, but I'm not surprised whatsoever by what you've come to know as hearing from all these different individuals, all these people coming out of the woodwork, because that is the case. You know, people always go, they look at the known sites, the BFRO, and a lot of these other databases out there. That is a drop in the bucket with the actual amount of sightings, visuals, and encounters. And I've noticed this over the years from California and Oregon, Washington. You know, there's difference, you know, depending on the generations, the small towns, the big towns, where people, some will talk, some won't. Up here in Pacific Northwest, you can't bump into one person, I'm telling you, without somebody they know, either them or someone they know that's had an encounter. And it's just the way it is, whether it's in their family or a friend. I've noticed that, and they never get reported. You know, it takes someone that really wants to share their encounter, that you know, for them to actually put it online or tell somebody. And with your museum, and I know this wasn't your intention, but it's kind of worked out that way for you, hasn't it? Where you get this influx of something you didn't expect to happen with people sharing their encounters and reports from all walks of life.
Yeah, we thought there might be a few. And I'll tell you something, we thought there, you know, my wife had already had it all figured out. We needed 27 people a day to paying customers that come through the door. So, you know what, I have such a passion for this. I mean, and you guys know what I'm talking about. When you have a passion for something, that's why you guys get out in the woods every day. You risk tick bites and snake bites, and you miss birthday parties and things, and, you know, you sweat, and it's just, it can be miserable at times. Well, I have the same kind of passion, but I really want to bring the information to the general public. That's what this is for. This museum is for. I'm bringing all this in. Oh my God, we got so much information out there. I mean, it's like overload. Now, you know, thanks to the internet. So I'm bringing as much of the good meaty stuff to the general public. And my wife and I were amazed at the support from the community. We are way busier than we could have ever hoped to be. And the people, there's so much interest in this. I had no clue as to the interest in this. We have been, since we opened up, we could just forget the 27 people a day. We do that in 15 minutes. We do an average of about, 24,000 people last year in the first 11 months with no advertising whatsoever. Wow. The interest in Bigfoot is still extremely strong, especially now that the show's off. There isn't that kind of outlet for them to watch the show, and the few shows that are out there are, you know, we need some more good shows. So but I mean, I just didn't know. I didn't know that there were this many people. And it's not just guys. My wife and I were flabbergasted as to see how many women, mothers, drag their kids in, and their husband will sit over on the couch because he's not that interested. And there's just as many women as men, if not more, that are interested in the subject matter. So, you know, we've learned a lot in the year and 4 months that we've been open, mainly that there's a lot more people interested in this. And if you think, if anybody out there that's listened to this has ever thought about opening up a Bigfoot museum, do it. Don't wait. I mean, the iron is hot right now. and there's so much good information out there. I wish to God there was 20 of these in the country right now, because I guarantee you, if you put it in a place where there's a good, steady amount of traffic, especially in a place where people like escape the city to get to the mountains, they're looking for that kind of adventure. I promise you, if you make it and you do a good job, I mean, you can't skip, you can't go cheap. I promise you that they will come.
Build it and come.
Exactly.
I guarantee it. I absolutely guarantee it. I can guarantee it.
Well, David, I want to talk about real quick. I want to talk about your museum here. I kind of want to close the show out talking about the museum, because it's on my bucket list, and it may even happen possibly down the road here this year. But I have one more question to do with research, something you mentioned earlier before we get to the specifics of your museum. You mentioned something earlier, and I was just curious about this. You mentioned, you know, that when you were placing your trail cameras, you were kind of, I believe, focusing on the power lines, kind of working those. What was your thought process behind? What was your thought process behind that?
Well, I knew that that they moved to the. I've had so many reports of people seeing them on power lines, so I had I had my camera set on camouflaged on trees. On the power line walkthroughs, not just on the power line trails, but I had them on also on some game trails too. And in the swampy areas, the power lines tend to run. They usually build that up so you can get in there in the rainy season and check your cameras. Whereas in the swamp, it can be just a flipping nightmare to get back there. I mean, I've gone there and set cameras up on game trails and perfectly dry. I go back there 90 days later and I'm up to my knees in water. Mm-hmm. And bugs and snakes. It's like this Vietnam horrible stuff, but I'll go back there anyway. So not only do the power line throughs were more active, I thought, but they were just so much more accessible.
Very good. Hey, let's get into the museum. Tell us, first of all, where is it located exactly?
It's in Cherry Log, Georgia, which is just about 4 miles south of Blue Ridge, Georgia. It's a little mountain town up here. And just so you know, I wasn't in a hurry to talk about the museum. I could talk about research and all day long.
Yeah.
I mean, I love talking about it because there's so many different ways to do it. God, there's just so many different ways to do it. And, you know, either going to people's houses or the state parks or national parks or game trails, or I mean, there's just so many, you know. Now I'm fiddling with long-term recorders, and right now I've got one out at a guy's property. I got a phone call. People calling me the museum. They have Bigfoots on the property. I've been known to close the museum and run down twice because people are in a panic. One, the lady said she had a red Bigfoot trying to get in her house at night, crying. So I had to shut the museum down, run down, set cameras up on her property. And another fellow up in North Carolina had seen one, retired Marine, and this guy was so traumatized that he wanted me to close up my museum. And it was on a weekend. I said, "But I wish I could, but he's not going to hurt you. You know, if he was going to hurt you, he would have already hurt you." So, I could talk about research all day. So, yeah, not to worry about that. It's a 4 miles south of Blue Ridge. And about 8 miles north of a little town, LJ, it's right on 515. It's right on the main road. And 5,000, it's almost 5,000 square feet. I was worried because I thought I was going to be able to fill it. Because when I first opened up, I had my collection, which is, you know, I don't care how big a collection you have. Look, you're not going to fill 5,000 square feet of museum with it.
No.
So I reached out to a whole bunch of my friends. Put some stuff out on Facebook. Of course, I contacted a lot of my previous witnesses. Dr. Jeff Meldrum was a huge help. God bless him. Let me tell you something, man. I put out a call to him, and I picked out the best casts, and so I have a great cast collection. But I tell you, I did not want to put like 100 casts in there, because if you put too much in there, then after about the 50th cast, they all look alike. So I wanted to put enough of a varying of casts in there, but kept it at only like about 15 to 18 casts I have in there right now, because that's not the only thing in there. It's not the only piece of evidence we have. I have a hair sample in there. We've got photographs and newspaper clippings and full-size backlit maps of Florida and Georgia, so you can actually see where you live and then where the sightings have been, with three different categories, whether it's a Class B, Class A, or habituation site. Two movie theaters, and Seth Breedlove from Small Town Monsters, what a great guy. I don't know if you've had a chance to watch in his movies, but just, I mean, he's just
oh,
so
yeah.
good at
oh, yeah.
it. So we've got permission. We sell his movies in our gift shop. We also show, I think, the best Bigfoot documentary ever made, which is The Beast of Boggy Creek. Him and Lyle Blackburn got together and made a great The Boggy Creek Monster is the name of that documentary. We show that in our big cinema. But we've got, I don't know how many exhibits we have in there. I just put five more on the wall in there, including the new Skunk Ape exhibit. We've got a Bigfoot dropping in there, so people always ask us, you know, always ask us when they come up. They're going to go hiking with the kids, you know, what do we look for? So I tell them, and I've got to a point where, like, why am I going to tell them? I'll just show them what to look for. So we have a whole exhibit of just Bigfoot sign with busted branches and pictures of structures and suspected wood breaks, and we have a 3-foot Bigfoot turd in there too, so they can see what Bigfoot droppings look like. And it just, we mix the gambit up, because I don't want to, we don't want to put out there that Bigfoot is the big forest giant, the big gentle forest giant, even though there are plenty of occasions where they are. But there's just as many occasions where these things, it kind of gets a little fuzzy as to what their real capacity is, depending on each particular individual. So suffice it to say that we present as much open-ended evidence, and then when people come in, they make up their own mind as to what Bigfoot is, and you know, whether they can, you know, how they wrap their head around it. We want people to make up their own mind. I don't make up their mind. I don't push any specific kind of thought process agenda. It's an extremely complex phenomenon. 3, 4, 5 dimension. No matter how which way you look at this thing, it's just got all kinds of different facets to it. So that's what we present to the public, and takes you anywhere from, you know, most people are back there for about 2 hours, but you can be back there for 3 hours. And sometimes we have people come back the next day. I think I missed something. Can I come back? Yeah, sure. So we get people come back 4 or 5 times, families. So we've been very, very blessed. Very blessed.
Yeah, so no matter what, yeah, no matter what, there, no matter your perspective on Sasquatch, no matter your background, there's something for everybody at this museum to take away from, whether you're just interested in the subject, you're an enthusiast, researcher, investigator, or just somebody who wants to get out of the sun. There's something to be taken away from your museum, and it sounds vast. It's actually, I can't even comprehend what it looks like in my mind.
Well, I'll tell you what, people keep the phone keeps ringing. Dave, I got a footprint. My buddy Robert Robinson from Florida at Legend Trippers just brought me a brand new foot cast from Washington. I've got one from Cliff Barachman back there. I've got another one from Tom Powell. God bless his heart. Love Tom Powell. I got another one from Meldrum. I now have foot casts. I have nowhere to put them. So I mean, I'm getting other things in that I have no place. I'm headed to Falk, Arkansas, the week after next, to pick up a very large artifact that's going to be it'll be its own display. Brian Impey out there put me on to a great guy named Doyle Holmes out there, and he's had ongoing activity out there, just crazy stuff going out there. Things are still happening in Falk, Arkansas. Just because you don't read it in the papers, I'm telling you, it's still extremely active out there. And Lyle Blackburn put me in touch with Brian Impey. So I tell you, if there's one thing that I tell people, come and say, hey, I want to be, how do I get into Bigfooting? You know, how do I get into this? And if I ever had one shred of advice to them, is be nice, and be nice to people. Whether you agree with what their thought process is in Bigfoot, be respectful, be nice. Because it's at some point, be nice to every researcher you meet. Be respectful of them and their feelings, and their, whether you agree with them or not, you can keep that to yourself. But because some point down the line, you may go, oh my God, that person I need to call that person because what he told me 2 years ago makes perfect sense. And if you can't pick up the call and call that investigator because you didn't mouth off or say something derogatory or negative to that person, you still have a good rapport with that person, you can call him and pick his head with some more stuff. And because your perspective on this is going to change from where you start to where you're going to be 2 years, 5 years, 10 years down the line, 15, 20, it's going to change. So I always tell people, God, be nice to each other. Some of my friends, we're all over the place. I'm sure some of my friends think I'm completely nuts because I just have an open mind, and I just think it's important to keep an open mind. So that's my one piece of advice to people getting started in this is don't start off on the wrong foot by shutting people down that have a different opinion than you do. It doesn't mean you don't have to agree with them, but please be respectful and be nice to them because that's the way I was raised, and it's worked very well for me. I have tons of friends in the Bigfoot world. I don't think I have a single person that I really don't like. And I hope it's the same way for people that know me. Even they don't agree with me, I certainly hope that they respect me and like me. And if they need anything, they can call on me. So if we're going to get to the answer of this thing, if we're going to get to the real answer to this thing, we're going to need each other. We really do need each other to do it.
Oh man, that's so refreshing to hear, David. So refreshing to hear because you're absolutely right. You know, and all the individuals that are working with you, a lot of them I know personally, a lot of them I've worked with, and a lot of them I've had on my show, those that you've talked to, worked with, and had contribute to your museum are just that, very open-minded, and they don't bash people, they don't attack people. And at the end of the day, I always say this, you know, when you start attacking people, whether you agree with them or not, you know, what are you bringing to the table? What are you doing yourself? You know, I think that's half the reason the subject doesn't get – we don't get further in the subject because there's not collaboration, and we're busy, or a lot of people are busy checking each other's pockets. What, you know, what are you hiding? What are you talking about? You're a liar, this and that. And at the end of the day, that's not research. That's just – it gets you nowhere. It's ridiculous. So those are well said words, and that's a well said comment. And kudos to you. I mean, your museum. You know, for those listening, get off social media. You know, get in the woods, and you want go to the museum. This museum sounds fantastic. I can't wait to get there and check it out because you've really put together a one of a kind thing. I know you poured your blood, sweat, and tears into this, your own money. And it's got a little bit of everything and a lot of stuff, and it's Bigfoot, people. This is why Monster X does the show, because we're really into the Sasquatch phenomena, and this museum, it sounds fantastic, and I can't say enough about what you've done, David, and your comments. Gunner, you got something to pipe in here, because you know what a great show.
Yeah, we're getting close to running out of time there, but I do want to thank our guest David Bacara today for joining us. We'll have to have you back on it and just talk Bigfoot more. It's always fun for me. Monster X is just the coolest thing because I got to get on and just talk to people about a subject that I'm passionate about, and I know that you guys are too. So again, David, I really want to say thanks for joining us today, and good luck with your museum. I'm sure that both Shane and I will get down there and stop by one of these days, and I hope that you have much success with it and continued success, and thank you again so much for being on Monster X today.
Thank you, fellows. A pleasure meeting you. I had a great time, and I hope to get to meet both of you real soon.
Yeah, that will happen, and we will have you back on for sure because you're a joy to talk to.
Thanks, guys.
Thank you, David.
All right, thanks,
David. Have a great evening.
Thanks, everybody, for listening to Monster X Radio. Next weekend, Shane and I will be doing a show. I know that we'll be both of us will be on our way back from Beachfoot 2017. So until then, have a great week, and get out there and get off social media, like Shane said, get in the woods, go look, find Bigfoot.
Thank you for joining Monster X Radio.